Dub Dynamic, a costume contest, tarot readings, and more. Project Northwest is a pro-black, pro-women, pro-queer online zine and showcase for hip-hop and R&B artists in the Pacific Northwest. Again, that's Hip Hop Halloween on Saturday, November 2nd, from 9 p.m. to midnight at the Atlantis Lounge inside Mississippi Pizza, 3552 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Portland Latin American Film Festival at the Hollywood Theater. The next film in the series, Song Without a Name, Canción Sin Nombre, is showing Wednesday, November 6th at 7:30 p.m. This visually striking period piece is a Kafka-esque crime thriller inspired by real events. A stranger-than-fiction true story of stolen babies in 1980s Peru provides the narrative inspiration of Leon's debut feature. Again, that's Song Without a Name, Canción Sin Nombre, showing Wednesday, November 6th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
We will not bow down to racism.
We will not bow down to
injustice.
We will not bow down to
exploitation. I'm gonna stand. I'm gonna stand.
Now this is time for free your mind and your soul. Yo, after the story has never been told. Ladies, you got to demand what you want, and what we want is respect, right?
Come and take a walk with me. Come so walk with these. See what only I can see.
Sisters, check this. Watch this.
To be clear and transparent, I am a member of, I'm on the co-chair on the e-board there. So you all should know that this will be a very consciously friendly interview. But I want people to know a bit of the history, the importance and significance, and the work that we do now. And then they can decide if they would like to take the pledge. The Jobs with Justice pledge is that you promise to show up at least 5 times in a year to someone else's struggle. We put people on the streets at protests, on picket lines, at strikes, and we think that it's important for people to be able to mobilize, to show power, and to affect change. So Will, if you would humor me, please talk a little bit about the history of Jobs with Justice, the how, but also the why. Why was Jobs with Justice started?
Thanks, Alyssa. Thanks again for having me. It's that's a great lineup you've had in your first couple shows, and we're all excited to see where your show goes. You know, how appropriate that the Jobs with Justice pledge that you mentioned includes the word struggle, and that's the name of your radio show. I think That says a lot about where Jobs with Justice was born out of and what we continue to exist for. Jobs with Justice started in the late 80s, actually, another time of fierce anti-union sentiment under Republican administration, when unions were really facing some steep attack and working people were facing steep attack. As a way and a model to bring forward, to bring more power to bear for workers than they might be able to achieve in their own as employees with a boss. There's workers are powerful in their workplace, but only that power can only go so far when you're confronted with enormous corporate interests or multinationals. And so, Jobs with Justice was born out of a desire and a call to involve more workers in labor struggles. So that's what's so great about Jobs with Justice is it doesn't take paying dues. We like it when people pay dues and or pay anything to help us run. We are a nonprofit organization, but our main mission is to bring more power to bear for the working class by involving everyone, whether you have a high-paying job, MD, a nurse, or a low-paying job, or no job, mm-hmm. that you can still show up five times a year for someone else's struggle is where Jobs with Justice was born out of and sprouted up in many different chapters around the country. And our chapter, the Portland Jobs with Justice chapter, started in the early 90s. I think instantly launched into a lot of different worker struggles and contract fights, and coming into the role, I've been in the job as director for a year and a half. To it's really kind of awe-inspiring to hear as you talk to union members and union leaders and workers about their history with Jobs with Justice and what we've been able to achieve together by bringing community power to bear on workplace struggles.
Beautiful. So I want to address elephants in all rooms everywhere. Every room in the world where there's an elephant, I want to address it. Not everyone is on board with the sentiment of every worker deserves a union, right? So when I was telling people on my social media that you were going to be here, that's how I started it out. Right, it's meant to be provocative. Every worker deserves a union, yet every worker doesn't have one. And there are forces that are very decisively trying to ensure that that doesn't change. So if someone has any sort of fear or apprehension around organizing their workplace with their coworkers, or is not sure whether it's even a good idea, what might you say to them?
Fear, that's a great question. It's something that all organizers confront, no matter whether it's workplace organizing or any of the other kinds of organizing that you mentioned, as we put people into motion to overcome fear. That is a natural response, certainly, to be afraid for what you have. But I think people, you can see behind their eyes when you're talking to people that they want to see justice. There's things that they want to see achieved. There's things that they know they see other people have that they deserve, whether it's fair treatment by police, whether it's, you know, good raises, health insurance, good health care, you name it. The call in our as humans, our call to achieve those things can be called forward by good organizing. Fear, and it's incredible to see people and workers step up and overcome their fears as you get to know them and get to work with them. Mm-hmm. To watch people put fear behind in the hopes of achieving something better. Mm-hmm. That doesn't end when you have a union. Union members are still afraid to take action and have to be organized too. It's not like you achieve a union or a union contract and you've got everything falling down from the sky for you, but so it takes ongoing organizing to put fear behind.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a lot of new organizing. One of the main thrusts of Portland Jobs with Justice this year has been, and years following too, but the Burgerville Workers Union. Mm-hmm. So shout out to all the Wobblies. Hello.
Hi.
I will be asking y'all to come on the show, so prepare yourselves. The Burgerville Workers Union is the first fast food union in the U.S. And it's so significant because as the jobs have sort of gone down in what you can get from them, you know, like the buying power, you know, the cost of living, the, you know, what it can get you. Anyway, many people are going into low wage work, and it's not their choice. You know, there's no such thing as low wage work. That your wages are supposed to be negotiated, except not everyone's wages are negotiated, and you sort of take what you can get, and you're supposed to have a smile on your face. This is how the Burgerville workers had previously been treated until the industrial workers of the world, one of the best organizations in the history of the world, decided that they were going to support the organizing of those workers. Now, many people that are maybe cynical at best, reactionary at worst, will actually say this job is not worth you getting a $5 raise, which was one of their original demands. You don't deserve $5 more an hour. You flip burgers, you make fries, and you know, all sorts of derogatory things that they say. Unfortunately, some of those workers and people in the general public may actually agree with that, that there's something there about that work is supposed to be low wage. Let's fight back against that. What do you have to say?
It's been incredible to see the Burgerville Workers Union stepping up. And for me, coming out of an organizing non-union workers is what I did for many years before I came to Jobs with Justice, and to see people taking on a completely non-union industry in the way that those workers have has been truly inspiring, and really proud that that historic victory is happening here in our city, and the role that Jobs with Justice has played in lifting up that struggle and connecting them with community involvement and direct action support and faith organizing around their struggle. That I think it's a shame that more workers don't see how badly we've all been treated by the system, and how all of our wages have been depressed by the power of capital, by the power of corporate America, where we are pitted against each other to say, why should they make more making hamburgers than I should drive in a truck or what have you. Mm-hmm. And it's when not to see that we've really all been mistreated and are all underpaid for the work that we do. And that's been what's so inspiring to see with the Burgerville Workers Union, is how they've persisted in challenging an industry that no one thought could be organized, and continue to meet expectations every mm-hmm. step of the way about what's possible. Mm-hmm. For me, I think it also is being more exposed to the Burgerville Workers Union in the last year and a half, of this idea of a revival in labor that we see seeds of there, of a movement that maybe has needs some new spirit, and to watch Burgerville workers at their picket lines that are full of song, full of participation, full of people stepping up and taking roles, full of creative direct action, and also full of camaraderie, how they really stick together, that you feel like when you're around Burgerville workers that this isn't just an effort to make some more money. It is an effort to build a community and build mutual support, build solidarity, is a core principle from what I can tell of that work so far. And especially when you see, they're not all young workers, but many are, to see this sort of spirit that brings to an organizing campaign is just really pulls you in and makes you want to keep showing up for Burgerville workers.
Okay. I want to plug another show on KBOO, Great. Labor Radio, for people who are listening that, may be hearing collective bargaining, pickets, and, some of the terms that are around labor organizing and are scratching your heads. I would absolutely suggest that you go to KBOO.fm and search for Labor Radio, and it goes in some much more depth about some of the things that we're talking about. I want this episode to be about Jobs with Justice, and it's very important to talk about unions, but the show is only about so long. So there's a plug. You're welcome, Jamie Partridge. So if there are people who are listening, and I hope there are people who are listening that want to form unions at their workplaces with their coworkers, what advice do you have?
I would say think of organizing like an iceberg, that there so much of the action is actually underwater, that what the is under the radar, so to speak, that people think of the union as a perhaps they think of the union as a strike or an election or some powerful moment, but there's so much that goes into building for that moment, and that what you do to build solidarity away from the boss, what you do to build solidarity among your workers, is what the rest of it is, what all those powerful moments of victory are based on. So there's, you know, so much. Even I'm a swimmer too. That's my workout. And you think of most of the actual movement in swimming is under the water, and not what you're doing on top of the water. What you're doing and what you're building matters most. What's happening between workers as you come together. That's the power, and that's what propels your effort forward. And being careful and strategic about when that comes to the surface, when you might confront your manager, when you might confront the boss, when you might confront corporate leadership, it matters a lot that you've built the kind of organization that can withstand a long effort. The boss in corporate America has quite a bit of power to throw at stopping unions, and believe that they will throw everything they can at stopping organizing. Mm-hmm. And so not taking shortcuts in building your organization early and before, and being ready when you start to publicly announce yourself, mm-hmm. or take on your employer.
I should say that if you do that careful organizing and want to confront your boss collectively with your coworkers, you can absolutely depend on Jobs with Justice to be there with you. I should say that.
We've come out time and again from, you know, many different campaigns, and that's the other, I mean, with Burgerville, I think it's, you see, it's a well-loved local employer, and these are exactly the kind of fights that Jobs with Justice was built for, whether it was Powell's workers or Alaska Airlines workers or, mm-hmm. or many other types of workers where we've engaged and helped out, that of not just corporations that we think are of as being damaging to the community, but even corporations that are respected in the community, where we can see a role, and where Jobs with Justice stands on the side of workers.
They're sort of like liberal sustainable food model is like, poverty wages are not very sustainable for your workers, but you know, whatever you want. So on this question of building the organization between workers before you try to confront the boss or make some demands or something like that, I wonder what you think that strong organization actually looks like, and how do you make the first step? I really do want listeners who are in jobs with no collective bargaining to have it. So like what might be the first step?
This is where it gets really tricky, is what who, like, because ultimately decisions need to be made and have to be or come to agreement on things of how you're going to proceed, and building to the kind of to that kind of unity is difficult and can be really trying. I think trusting workers to know how to build their own organization is valuable and important, and something I think we can learn a lot from Burgerville workers, that there's all sorts of ways that a union can look and be structured. but just knowing that there's always trade-offs, right? If it's a consensus model, or if it's, you know, staff organizing, or whatever it is, there's always going to be trade-offs in how that works, and what risks that puts your organizing at. So I wouldn't say there is like a hard and fast solution for how you build a structure. It would depend on the industry.
Okay.
I think we are excited to see what social media and other technology tools we have now that we never did before.
Mm-hmm.
Although that also, I think those tools can create isolation as much as they can create solidarity. But they, like, we've also seen moments both internationally and in our country around how workers have organized or people have organized, frankly, using technology and using social media.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, like, that provides a lot of tools, but isn't, we should be careful to not see that as a shortcut either,
or a
crutch as we try to build a worker organization.
Yeah, you can't have a picket line on Twitter. So, and, you know, yes, you know, write about it, get it out, get the message out. But, you know, there's something about, feet on the streets or wheels on the streets. If you wheel around, we love you. Disability justice, baby. So I should say, coming to Jobs with Justice now, I already made the pitch for the pledge, which is part of my job as co-chair. You go out and you try to get people to sign the pledge. The pledge very simply says, again, I will show up to 5 other struggles in a calendar year, and you can count on me. I will be there. I will be one of the bodies that you put in the street at protests or on the picket at a strike, or any other number of workplace actions or organizations that we support and mobilize people for. So, Will, let's say people who are listening right now go to the Jobs with Justice website and sign the pledge to show up. What will happen after they show up? After they sign the pledge, what will happen?
The first and most immediate thing that happens is you get onto our email list. It's a weekly Wednesday email that we send to all of our pledgers about actions that have been endorsed that week. That list has grown about probably 3,000 or so that we send to weekly.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives you kind of a menu of things of how you could meet your pledge week to week. And then, you know, we are also very active on social media. We have a large and growing Facebook presence, Twitter, and now Instagram, our newest channel. And so all those are ways where you can find out about things and ways to meet your pledge. And, you know, not all of these are on the streets. We love the direct actions and being on the street, but that we also sign letters, we make phone calls. There are any number of ways where we've provide solidarity, mm-hmm. or add power to workers in struggle. We are largely volunteer driven, mm-hmm. you know, a 20-member elected executive board that help run volunteer committees, program committees that we do around healthcare, immigration, global justice, Portland Rising, like an education arm about union history and union struggles. And what else am I missing? Those are a lot of the key ones of what we, in our faith labor committee that mobilizes people of faith to show up for workers.
Excellent. Just because you brought it up, talking about the upping our social media game, I should plug it. We are on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, Portland Jobs with Justice. Please follow. And shout out to AJ and Justin on staff.
AJ, Justin.
We love you. Thank you for all of your work and for making our social media more relevant. It's excellent. We have a lot of good content. So I wonder if you can talk about some of the highlights that so far this year or as of late that you would like for people to know about.
Great. Except we've talked about Burgerville. Another struggle we've worked a lot on, speaking of disability rights, is around TriMet bus operators. It's for paratransit service. That's the sort of short buses that you see driving around. Workers work for are outsourced by TriMet, by our public agency, to a company called First Transit. First Transit's a multinational. You see them as like First Group or First Student that drive some of the yellow school buses too. It's a huge global employer, and we were first talked to by workers from Lyft Paratransit that are members of Amalgamated Transit Union Local 757 about issues on the job.
757.
Right away about the connections that those drivers have with their passengers, many of whom are disabled or seniors. What these buses do is get people from point A to point B that could not access a fixed bus route or get to a max line, so they can pick you up and drop you off, mm-hmm. As long as you have some certification of need for that service. Mm-hmm. There are hundreds of these workers in the metro area, and instantly, as we heard about the struggles on that job, we also connected that with the struggles that the riders were going through about lack of access to bathrooms, lack of access to breaks or being able to get off of the buses, mm-hmm. poor drivers, poor working conditions, where riders, poor riding conditions, and lifted up that struggle through our workers' rights board. And other, we had sort of speak out events for disabled and senior passengers over this year, and recently saw that those workers settled a fair contract or were able to ratify a new contract with First Transit to improve wages and pay. And I think the workers are saying that they wouldn't have gotten the kind of agreement that they did without Jobs with Justice lifting up this community support. We want to make sure that the rider issues are still there, still present, and we will continue moving surveys, lifting up rider voices and voices from the disabled community about what's going on those buses. We're excited about a number of organizing campaigns that are going on locally, and all sorts of union contract struggles that we're involved in, as well as most recently on hopefully on the election day, we have a lot of victories that we can point to, and how we got the word out about Measure 105 and Measure 103 and other ones that are so damaging for our community.
Vote no on 105. Little jingle. One of the things that you can expect in terms of creative actions, which Jobs with Justice does a number of, is Will Lang might sing at your protest.
Happened before, yeah.
Will sings and plays the guitar, and if you would have it, Will Lang, would you play us a little something now?
I will, yeah.
Some social justice folk music.
Thank you, and thanks for letting me do this. but the struggle means music and having fun too, I think. I got maybe a couple songs if we can fit them in. This one is a newer song for me. I wrote, I've been going to NORCOR. I speak Spanish too, and I've been going to NORCOR to help interpret for
You say what NORCOR is?
It's the I think Northern Oregon Correctional Facility. It's become a housing facility. They've started, there's ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement.
You got some backup so that your music can be on point.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yes. Beautiful.
Thanks to our KBOO.
Yes. Thank you, Teresa.
KBOO team. ICE with the increasing detention of immigrants has been this public facility. It is a public jail in the Dalles, has been holding detainees and for the federal government. And these aren't criminals. Some of them have history, but it's in the past. Most of them have served their time or paid their debt. But here they are in jail, mm-hmm. It's been my first experience actually being in a jail and talking to people and hearing their stories, or interpreting for attorneys there and hearing the stories is pretty is been very powerful and very haunting. So this is the song I wrote about that called Nothing to Believe. It's written as like a duet or a husband and wife.
I can't sing with you.
A husband and I'll sing both parts. Save your voice. As a husband and wife communicating with each other through the glass or through video chat, a video call that's common now in jails. And I learned one that uses the term send a kite, and that's a term in jail when you're sending a message to the people in charge of the jail. That's called sending a kite, which when I first heard that, I thought was a powerful, powerful phrase.
Yes.
Something wrong, there's nothing wrong. Things seem strange, they're the same, they're the same. You're in jail, yes, I'm in jail. What do you need? Throw my bail, throw my in charge, tell him please get back my heart, get back my heart. Mother, mother, don't you cry, there's no sense to wonder why. So different now to me. Seem like I'm seeing you from the bottom of the sea. And you just can't believe what's become of me. Can't believe that there's nothing to believe. Can't believe that there's nothing to believe. To believe. To believe. Your eyes are brown, your cheeks are red. Gentle touch is in my head, it's in my head. Tie the string around my thumb. You can run. To believe, to believe. nothing to believe, to believe.
Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Alyssa.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, let's get that on iTunes.
Got to get it out, yeah.
Yeah. And then we can have the proceeds go to Jobs and Justice.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, okay. We will do that.
Hit us up.
And how about some immigration justice organizations that are doing the work, right? Since, like, that's the thrust of the song, right, where it came from. So on that...
You know, I think the other thing out of this is how many of these people they were working as landscapers or working in a kitchen when they were picked up, detained, and so many of them are married to citizens or have kids. Some of them have teenage kids, you know, that were born here, citizens of this country, and it's, you know, that is especially powerful to see how enmeshed these people are in our country. These aren't like they've been hiding out for years. They are part of the community. They work real jobs, important jobs, but not really in demand jobs. And what this does to families, you know, because these immigration cases are. Take a long time. They're very slow moving, especially with the current administration not in a hurry to move any of these move cases forward. And so what that's doing to families, and, you know, I think about people from conservatives that have talked for years about family values, and it really kind of hits you over the head when you're seeing this up front about what this does to families, and it makes you wonder whose families they're talking about when they talk about family values, because this is an atrocity happening and that our government is putting together.
Okay, so let's go there. Let's talk about it. The Global Justice Committee at Jobs with Justice. Jobs with Justice is comprised of a lot of committee work, and some of our best work comes out of our committees. And I think absolutely some of the best work comes out of the Global Justice Committee. And people should know that their analysis is very sharp in terms of understanding that immigration, you know, moving around the planet is not something that comes out of a vacuum. You leave the place that you grew up and made your life and had a good life because it was disturbed. Thinking about the caravan that's coming up right now from Honduras, they should be able to live full, happy lives, free of fear. But they can't in Honduras, because frankly, the U.S. government, the military, has undermined democracy and installed dangerous people in power that oppress, violate, and torture the population, all so that corporate interests can be served. So they're living in dangerous conditions, and they have to move like anyone else would. So I think it's very important for people to bear that in mind, because yes, have some humanity and realize that, you know, immigrants in the U.S. are very hard workers, and you know, they you know, really earn their keep. They're good people. They're good family people. I mean, sometimes I think that can give way to the sort of good immigrant, bad immigrant narrative, because, like, I think that people that don't work particularly particularly hard or maybe don't have a family should be able to come here too. So I think it's important to when we can, when it makes sense, talk about what gives rise to the immigration in the first place. There is not a huge influx of immigration, people seeking asylum that come from France. They're doing relatively okay. They have not been attacked by the U.S. Their society has not taken a hit in the name of imperialism and global domination. So, you know, the heft of people that seek asylum in the U.S. are people that come from the colonized world. Are we really not going to address this? Anyway, victory to the caravan, okay? I'll say that.
Yeah, our Global Justice Committee is very clear on this. And actually, a couple of us were just at an event last night, the Collins Summit that Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon hosted, which was all about human migration this year. And the sort of keynote speaker in an earlier part of the day was very clear that, like, immigration follows trade, that production of raw materials happens in the south or on the equator and moves to the north, and that's the way. So of course that's the drive of why people want to come, that they're following trade routes. And you know, even within in that group, the facilitator asked, there was probably 30 of us, and asked everybody to turn to someone else and then talk about what brought you to this town, to Portland or to Oregon. And for almost everybody, it was a job or following a job. And that, so even within our country, this is how people move, is for a better life. And that's what we see there. And certainly in Honduras and in the Central American countries, that's, you know, comes out of decades of U.S. involvement politically and certainly economically in these countries, of reduce and also exporting gang violence back to those countries, exporting drugs to those back to those countries, and that is what's driving this. And so I think I saw something about, and I'm no messaging expert, but that the caravan is really an exodus, that and it does feel almost biblical, although it's a very, this is a tiny amount of people and they're still 1,000 miles away, mm-hmm. but the conditions are just so bad that they're looking for some way to get forward. And then you see how our government tries not to even allow legal immigration or people to go through the supposed channels of how they're supposed to come in, sure. and drags that on for years too, sure. of how are people, what do we owe people of Honduras, what do we owe people of El Salvador, what do we owe people of Guatemala? And yep. I think it's quite a lot. I think those countries would look vastly different if it wasn't for U.S. involvement there over decades.
That is absolutely right. The question of merit, right? Like this is what the administration is putting forward as the people who should be allowed to come. You know, we should move to a merit-based system, meaning we only want the best of, you know, the best people, you know, to come from those countries to the U.S. And again, reiterating what I said before, I think that establishes a hierarchy that is very toxic, and I don't think that we should be valuing people based on their potential output, like what they can do economically. That's not humane. It's not okay, and it will require a struggle against it. And I know that there are people from all over, including people from Portland, who are going to go down to the border and try to render aid to some of the people that are going to be coming up, because in addition to the thousands of troops that are going to be down there that 45 has been bragging about, there are also going to be a lot of white nationalists that are going to go down there and wreak all sorts of havoc, no doubt. And I don't even want to say what I think might happen, but I don't think it will be good. And again, I say victory to the caravan.
And these troops, you know, the troops themselves are going to miss Thanksgiving, Christmas. Like, for what? Like, I feel, you know, like, how they're being treated is ridiculous, too.
Well, there is a legacy of soldier resistance, you know, thinking back to Vietnam. Many soldiers realized that it was a deeply unjust war, an attack on the Vietnamese people, and they began to organize and revolt collectively. And I think it would be great if we saw something like that again, don't you?
The other, you know, I think the other word that you mentioned was merit, and that really brings up, I think, unionists or folks involved in the labor movement would instantly recognize that word as, or have it would challenge that word as merit for who, who's deciding what merit is. And this is something that is prominent in union and labor discussions, is around what's the fairest way to divide up resources, and you know, employers, bosses, 45 will say it's for
45 is Trump. I just don't like to say his name.
I just can't say it. Yes, Trump, or you know, the would say merit is this, but everybody else would say, well, I have a different version of merit. So looking for ways that take that subjectiveness out of decisions about who's going to get what and when, that it would not be based on one man's vision of what's meritable in our economy, in our country.
What should labor's role be in this struggle right now?
I think we're seeing lots of signs of unions and workers coming together in organization and stepping up in more militant ways. I think to stop austerity, to turn back the sort of tide that we've heard for so long about, that we just can't afford the kind of government services that we need or that we should have. And so we're very inspired about what teachers have done around the country to take action for the kind of schools that they want and that they know that students want. I think that is a big deal when public employees that make up a lot of the labor movement currently are not just negotiating for more, but actually taking action for more and to push back against what right wing has been pushing for so long, that we can't afford the sort of services that we need, and that we know that's not true. We can certainly afford it.
Yeah.
So I think that's one thing. And I think with the other thing for Jobs with Justice now is what's the future of the labor movement where we've been under such attack for so long? But, you know, the decline in union membership predates 45, certainly.
Yes,
and
yes.
So I think being willing to take risks in exploring how workers can come together, and trying new ways. You know, a lot of our system of union organizing dates back to the 20s or 30s and 40s.
Oh, yeah.
And like anything could use a refresh. It's become, you know, very legalistic and could really benefit by taking some risks and trying some new things to see what we can do to keep worker organization a real thing for young workers and for workers in the future.
So I want to circle back to this, actually, particularly on the question of what should labor's role be around this question of immigration justice. But I just want to say two words that you mentioned, austerity and neoliberalism, just in case, you know, people don't know. I don't want to assume they're buzzwords, you know?
Sure, yeah.
Austerity is sort of putting your society on a diet. Often it looks like saying unapologetically, yes, we know that it's the capitalist class, the investment class that got us into this financial crisis that we're staring at. They gambled with public money and they lost. Of course, the executives on the team got big bonuses, but we'll keep saying that they lost. And actually, y'all are going to bear the brunt of this. So that means a cut to your social services, a cut to your benefits. And so sorry, but that's what you got. And by the way, that is why whenever you see austerity cuts, the only thing that does not get cut time and time again is what, ladies and gentlemen? The police. The police are a very important part of an austerity project. With austerity comes a higher police presence, a militarized police presence, more and more, because it's very clear that when people are oppressed so blatantly, like through being put on an austerity program, they will resist, and you need to be able to put down that resistance. And that is the role of that. And that entire turn towards financialization that gives way to the crises that make austerity so prevalent is what we would call neoliberalism, and not cultural liberalism, like, you know, good people that have In Our America signs on their lawns. No, economic liberalism, one that prioritizes the market and establishes a sort of market supremacy over the society. And it's often called capitalism getting its groove back. There were gains that were made by people's struggles in decades in the past, but there was a turn around the 80s, not just in the US, but around the world, where Wall Street really began to flex, and there was the employer's offensive. It goes hand in hand with the decline of unions. They were able to successfully smash them. Do you have anything to add around that?
That's quite a lot there. And as always, full of truth, and very much appreciate your voice.
Thanks, Will.
I don't think there's much I can add to that. You asked about immigration and the role of unions,
yes,
too. And
please.
I think this idea of what we call bargaining for the common good, or that union struggle, is so powerful when it connects to larger community interests.
So when it's at its best.
What you see with the teachers taking action around class sizes, or workplaces with immigrant high number of immigrants in them that work with community groups around what sort of protections they're going to provide, and being a sanctuary for immigrant members of unions or immigrant people in their organization is so powerful when you can see that connection of organized labor working together with their natural allies and using their power to negotiate for the benefit of all. And I think something that can go all sorts of ways, whether it's bus passes that reduce our carbon footprint, or class sizes, or sanctuary work sites. There's all sorts of ways that can be done, and we see lots of experimentation with unions that want to do that and are seeking to do that.
Beautiful. I want to say that I would like to see the national unions actually sending their own caravans down to the border and defending migrants seeking asylum. It can be done. It was recently done in Puerto Rico when Hurricane Maria hit, and the AFL-CIO, the American Federation of Labor, and the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the sort of umbrella organization that most national unions affiliate to. That's what it is. There's a whole history. Again, listen to Labor Radio. Or call me, and I can talk to you about this. I do trainings, and you can absolutely hire me, no problem. But yeah, they sent people down in planes to go down to Puerto Rico to render aid, and I think that is when organized labor is at its best. So if anyone listening has any strings at all that you could pull, let them know that we're watching, and we think that they should probably be involved in an unapologetic way.
That's so powerful in that way. When, you know, when there's a need for healthcare professionals, we see that that's not being provided, and workers' organizations themselves say, "Well, we can do that. We'll do that ourselves." Was a great moment when that happened in Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about just this last summer, the Occupy ICE movement, right, actually stopping the business at the ICE facility. Jobs with Justice was down there just about every day. We had people that were there, and I think that it was such a great example of different community organizations that don't necessarily have a standing orientation toward immigrant justice showing up. And the I hope that ATU doesn't get mad at me for talking about this, but it was some of the bus drivers that the ICE building was on their route that would tip us off about some of the activity that they saw around the ICE building when, you know, fascists would show up and, you know, try to bully people around and, you know, cause violence and deploy any, you know, number of anti-immigrant messages and try to instill fear in people. Yeah, it was the bus drivers that were in solidarity with the movement. And I was even toward the end of the occupation, and of course it was swept by DHS with the help of our mayor. I'm just gonna say it, sorry if you love Ted Wheeler. DHS swept the occupation. If it would have been able to keep going, I was actually looking forward to working with ATU about some solidarity stuff that they might have been able to do for the occupation. But c'est la vie. So Will, I think that the people might want to be blessed with another song.
One more song,
if you're feeling musical. Play us out.
Thank you, and thank you for letting me play these songs too. What a great show. What a great opportunity. Thank you for letting me be on.
Absolutely.
This last one is called Night of the Johnstown Flood, and it's written about a historic flood that happened in 1889 outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in an industrial town called Johnstown, Pennsylvania. But it wasn't just an accidental flood. It was the Fricks and the Carnegies owned a huge reservoir that they hunted around called the South Fork Dam, and they did not maintain their dam, and on a big rainstorm it washed away and swept away this entire working class town of Johnstown, Pennsylvania. This is before really the dawn of organized labor, but really sort of was one of the early signs of where we were going with rampant capitalism and rampant owners taking and not giving back.
Mm.
So here you go. It's in waltz time.
Thank you.
I work at the Connie Moss Steelworks 6 days a week. Springtime in the valley, peaches out on the trees. We moved 6 years ago. The South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club owns land round the lake. But it rained so hard on that morning that their levee had to break, and I lost everything I'd own. Our world turned into mud the night of the Johnstown flood. Washed away, washed away. Did anyone ever pay? Mr. Frick and Mr. Carnegie never paid a cent. They gave dollars to charity and said that was money well spent. But a train smashed into my home. I think back now to those Sundays, strolling at the park, and the happy song of a bluebird as the day grew dark. That Jonestown house, my last home.
This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator, the host of The Struggle, every Friday from 7 to 8 p.m. Listen to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, and online at kboo.fm. The Struggle is where organizers and activists doing good in the community come to discuss their work to get you to support them, maybe even join them. Remember The Struggle, every Friday, 7 to 8 p.m., KBOO Community Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of TEDx Mount Hood 2019.